Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryankaravavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastamavidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sarigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, page 56. Chapter 6, The Downfall of Saubari Muni. Pratigya, one must give up the association of persons interested in sex life, because in this way one can cross to the other side of the material ocean. But Saubari Muni, although alone, associated with the sexually engaged fish. Srila Narottam Das Thakur recommends that one engage in the service of the acharyas. And if one wants to live in association, he must live in the association of devotees. Therefore, a secluded place is not always secure unless there is good association. Adhyaya Prakashika. After describing the descendants of Maharaj Ambarish, Sukadev Goswami described all the kings from Shasada to Mandata, and in this connection he also described how the great sage Saubari married the daughters of Mandata. Maharaj Ambarish had three sons, named Virupa, Ketuman, and Shambhu. The son of Virupa was Prishadashva, and his son was Ratitara. Ratitara had two sons. Had no sons. Where did two come from? Wow. I don't even see a T there. Yeah, also in Ratitara. But when he requested the favor of the great sage Angira, the sage begot several sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. When the sons were born, they became the dynasty of Angira Rishi and of Ratitara. The son of Manu was Ikshvaku, who had 100 sons, of whom Vikukshi, Nimi, and Dandaka were the eldest. The sons of Maharaj Ikshvaku became kings of different parts of the world. Because of violating sacrificial rules and regulations, one of these sons, Vikukshi, was banished from the kingdom. By the mercy of Vishishta and the power of mystic yoga, Maharaj Ikshvaku attained liberation after giving up his material body. When Maharaj Ikshvaku expired, his son Vikukshi returned and took charge of the kingdom. He performed various types of sacrifices, and thus he pleased the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This Vikukshi later became celebrated as Shashada. Vikukshi's son fought with the demons for the sake of the demigods. And because of his valuable service, he became famous as Puranjaya, Indravaha, and Kakuchta. The son of Puranjaya was Aneha. The son of Aneha was Pritu. And the son of Pritu was Vishagandhi. The son of Vishagandhi was Chandra. The son of Chandra was Yuvanashva. And his son was Shravasta, who constructed Shravasti Puri. The son of Shravasta was Brihadashva. Brihadashva's son, Kuvalayashva, killed a demon named Dundhu, and thus he became celebrated as Dundhumara, the killer of Dundhu. The sons of the killer of Dundhu were Dridhashva, Kapilashva, Bhadrashva. He also had thousands of other sons, but they burned to ashes in the fire emanating from Dundhu. The son of Dridhashva was Haryashva. The son of Haryashva was Nikumbha. The son of Nikumbha was Bahulashva. And the son of Bahulashva was Krishashva. The son of Krishashva was Senajit, and his son was Yuvanashva. Yuvanashva married 100 wives, but he had no sons, and therefore he entered the forest. In the forest, the sages performed a sacrifice known as Indra-yagya on his behalf. Once, however, the king became so thirsty in the forest that he drank the water kept for performing yagya. Consequently, after some time, a son came forth from the right side of his abdomen. The son, who was very beautiful, was crying to drink breast milk, and Indra gave the child his index finger to suck. Thus the son became known as Mandata. In due course of time, Yuvanashva achieved perfection by performing austerities. Thereafter, Mandata became the emperor and ruled the earth, which consists of 7 islands. Thieves and rogues were very much afraid of this powerful king, and therefore the king was known as Trishadyashu, meaning one who is very fearful to rogues and thieves. Mandata begot sons and the wife of his wife, Bindumati. These sons were Puru Kutsa, Ambarisha, Mukunda, and Mukunda. These 3 sons had 50 sisters, all of whom became wives of the great sage known as Salbari. In this connection, Sukadev Goswami described the history of Salbari Muni, who, because of sensual agitation caused by fish, fell from his yoga and wanted to marry all the daughters of Mandata for sexual pleasure. Later, Salbari Muni became very regretful. Thus he accepted the order of Vanaprastha, performed very severe austerities, and thus obtained perfection. In this regard, Sukadev Goswami described how Salbari Muni's wives also became perfect. Shloka Anusharanam, verses 1-3. The descendants of Maharaj Ambarish, verses 4-38. The descendants of Ikshvaku, verses 39-55. The downfall and liberation of Salbari Muni. Verses 1-3. The descendants of Maharaj Ambarish. Sri Sukadev Goswami said, O Maharaj Parikit, Ambarish had 3 sons named Virupa, Ketuman, and Shambhu. From Virupa came a son named Prishadashva, and from Prishadashva came a son named Ratitara. Ratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons in the womb of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with brahminical prowess. Srila Prabhupada explains. In the Vedic age, a man was sometimes called upon to beget sons in the womb of a lesser man's wife for the sake of better progeny. In such an instance, the woman is compared to an agricultural field. A person possessing an agricultural field may employ another person to produce food grains from it, but because the grains are produced from the land, they are considered the property of the owner of the land. Similarly, a woman was sometimes allowed to be impregnated by someone other than her husband, but the sons born of her would then become her husband's sons. Such sons were called Kshetra Jata. Because Ratitara had no sons, he took advantage of this method. So, but their sons by Jatita, Kshetra Jata, means he's married to his wife, so therefore that connection there, any sons born of her, they belong to who's married to the woman. That's the system. Not that then the husband, no, he's my son. No, that doesn't count. Who the woman is connected with, that's who the children belong to. Right? Does that make sense? That's the method here. So it's said sometimes. It's not a standard method. Manu mentions it as it's a bona fide method, you know, in the other ages. In Kali Yuga, it can't be used. But he mentions that it's a strange method, you know. But, you know, it's there if one needs to use. So in this case, because he couldn't have children, then it can be done. Then it would be the brother then would generally beget sons, but it also can be the sages, right? Because then you get a better quality of the children like that. So we see at the end of Parasaram's tour that after 21 generations, there were no Kshatriyas left, but only the Kshatriya women were there, the queens were there. So then they, through sages, beget children. And so then their children became the kings. And they were like Brahmins. So then it was considered a golden age. So it was like Satyayuga, even though it was I think, what was it? Treta at the time. And so, yeah. So we see in history these things happen. But it's attributed to, this method is attributed to Vena. that he's the one who introduced this system. So that's why it's considered usable, but a little strange. Right? But in Kali Yuga, it's one of the five things that are not allowed. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, having been born from the womb of Ratitara's wife, all these sons were known as the dynasty of Ratitara. But because they were born from the semen of Angira, they were also known as the dynasty of Angira. Among all the progeny means they are known by that, but who they're going to perform their duties will be their father, will be Ratitara. Does that make sense? Yes.
Is there any mention of adoption in the Vedas?
Yes, no adoptions there. It's one of the 12 types. Means that you have your own son, that's considered the best. Right? Then this one, this, you know, was mentioned then through someone else. Like that. So the first six, then they're considered superior to the second six. I don't remember all the detail. So the adopted son, I think, is in the second six.
Like Kunti that. Was also adopted.
Sorry?
Kunti. She was given.
Yes.
She was an adopted child.
Yes, yes. So it's one of the 12 kinds. But it's not considered your first choice. But, you know, if need be, or just somebody so you know. However it works out, that it's perfectly bona fide, and they become the son. So, yes, it's there. Just like there's 8 ways that one could get married, so there's 12 ways one can have a child. Right there.
This is from
Manu? Yes, Manu.
And what about, do they do, like, egg donations and things like that?
Exonations.
Is that outside of the
wedding?
Yeah, no, that's it. Oh, as a donation.
Egg donation.
Okay. Huh?
Egg donation.
Egg donation. See, in here, in the Vedic system, the eggs are in the lady.
Yeah, yeah, but nowadays they take out the egg from one lady to another lady. Impregnate that egg and then put that in the womb of another lady.
That's yeah. Probably number 13.
I think it's actually 27 and a half. But then the point is whose is it? Because technically it'll be whoever the surrogate mother's her child. You understand? Because she's the field, and that means that child belongs to her husband. But of course, these days she doesn't have a husband, so. It's just like this. Can I take paneer tikka and put it on a pizza?
Why would you do that?
Yeah, that's the point. Why would you do that? But you go to the pizza places, they have it. So you can do so many things.
I just want to know if it's like it's okay.
No, it's not a Vedic process. Vedic process is, you know, they stick to the standard things. All the children born are born according to standard methods. But it's just a matter of who the son's born to and who the father, this and that. That's the consideration.
Will they become birds if they're born from the egg?
I'm not sure. Could be. Because the point is that it's still the other person's field. But if you make some arrangement, then that can be there, just like you have the, what is it? Is it called the pointed daughter? Is that the term? That means that the father gives his daughter to the boy for marriage on the condition that the first son born to her, first child born, will become his son. It won't be his grandson. You understand? So he'll be raised as the father of the girl's son. Like that. I think it's called appointed daughter. So you do have these things. So based on that, you can say, okay, then it's by appointment. That's by previous agreement that this is how it's going to be. You understand? But if you want to get down to just legally, it's whoever gives birth to the child, her husband, it's his child. does that make sense? But if there's an agreement, then you can say, okay, this and that. So if they want to take the eggs, juggle them a bit, you know, like this and that, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, you know, or whatever it is. But you can do these things. The point is this, there's mathematical calculations of what you can do. But the point is out of those, only a certain amount of those are actually good. So in the modern, they come up with more and more weird things. You can do that, and you'll probably end up as some, you know, more and more weirder species that actually, that's the way things work.
You just wanted to know if it's simple to do that.
Right? It's strange.
Quite common,
actually. But I'm saying it's strange, as is pointed out. Anything other than man marries a woman, they have a child, and that child is their child. Anything other than that, it's considered not as good. So he has 12 different kinds of children, and each one is given in gradation of order. You know, first best, second best, third best, down to 12th best. And as we mentioned here, we're talking about 13th on. 13th not so best. Right? Because the second six are considered inferior to the first six. Just like in marriages, the first four are considered superior, the second four are considered inferior. So seeing that the modern marriage is generally based on one of those second group of inferior, then therefore it can't be all that great. You know what I'm saying? So, in other words, these must be methods that are used by, you know, various animals or something like that. So means we don't know, but there's 8,400,000 species. So you'll end up on some strange planet somewhere where the, how you say, mine funny little blue rocks and people live in trees. You know, so, you know, horses have six legs. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so there's all kinds of stuff going on. Yeah? Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, having been born from the womb of Ratitara, we already mentioned that. Among all the progeny of Ratitara, these sons were the most prominent because owing to their birth, they were considered brahmanas. Like that. So they were considered brahmanas, so they must have also acted in that capacity. Because if they didn't act in that capacity, they wouldn't be considered brahmanas. Right? Just like of, what was it, Rishabdev's sons. Wasn't it his sons? Or Bharat Maharaj's sons? Rishabdev had 100 sons. So of them, 80 were brahmanas. Then 11 were kshatriyas. No, 11 were paramahamsas and 9 were kshatriyas. And of those then, Bharat Maharaj was the head of those ones who were kshatriyas. Like that. So if they say they were considered brahmanas, means they acted like brahmanas. Verses 4-38, the descendants of Ikshvaku. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, the son of Manu was Ikshvaku. When Manu was sneezing, Ikshvaku was born from Manu's nostrils. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Huh? Yeah. Okay. King Ikshvaku had 100 sons, of whom Vikukshi, Nimi, and Dandaka were the most prominent. Footnote 15. Sridhar Swami states that although the Bhagavatam 9.1, 11-12 was previously included, has previously included Ikshvaku among the 10 sons begotten by Manu and his wife Shraddha. This was a generalization. It is here specifically explained that Ikshvaku was born simply from the sneezing of Manu. Right, so he said before he had these sons, but actually this one he was sneeze. I say a sneeze child. Right. Of the 100 sons, 25 became kings in the western side of Aryavarta, a place between the Himalaya and Vindhya mountains. Another 25 sons became kings in the east of Aryavarta, and the 3 principal sons became kings in the middle. So Aryavarta, that's from the Indian Ocean to the Bay of Bengal, north of India, south of Himalayas, that whole track. So Bengal, Bihar, UP, over, what is it then? We have Punjab, Rajasthan, Sindh like that. So it concludes that whole area. So then, yeah. So 25 on the western side, 25 in the right, and the 3 in the middle. And 3 in the middle. The other sons became kings in various other places. During the months of January, February, and March, oblations offered to the forefathers are called Astaka Shraddha. The Shraddha ceremony is held during the dark fortnight of the month. When Maharaj Ikshvaku was performing his oblations in this ceremony, he ordered his son Vikukshi to go immediately to the forest to bring some pure flesh. Okay, so this is during the dark, because the dark fortnight, that's the day of the Pitris. And the light fortnight, that's there when they sleep. Thereafter, Ikshvaku's son, Vikukshi, went to the forest and killed many animals, suitable for being offered as oblations. But when fatigued and hungry, he became forgetful and ate a rabbit he had killed. Srila Prabhupada comments to verse 7. It is evident that Kshatriyas killed animals in the forest because the flesh of the animal was suitable to be offered at a particular type of yajna. Offering oblations to the forefathers in the ceremony known as Shraddha is also a kind of yajna. In this yajna, flesh obtained from the forest by hunting could be offered. However, in the present age, Kali Yuga, this kind of offering is forbidden. Quoting from the Brahma Vaivartya Puran, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "In this age of Kali, 5 acts are forbidden. The offering of a horse in sacrifice, the offering of a cow in sacrifice, the acceptance of the order of sannyas, the offering of oblations of flesh to the forefathers, and a man's begetting children in his brother's wife." According to Vedic injunctions, however, only Kshatriyas are allowed to hunt, whereas Shudras are allowed to eat flesh after offering goats or other insignificant animals before the deity of goddess Kali or similar demigods. On the whole, meat-eating is not completely forbidden. A particular class of men is allowed to eat meat according to various circumstances and injunctions. As far as eating beef is concerned, however, it is strictly prohibited to everyone. Thus, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna personally speaks of go-raksham, cow protection. Meat-eaters, according to their different positions and the directions of the Shastra, are allowed to eat flesh, but never the flesh of cows. Cows must be given all protection. Right? So these are all different aspects that are accommodated in the Vedic, but under strict regulation, and only certain groups of people take advantage of it. Otherwise, others aren't interested in these things, right? Like that. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Vaishnavas are allowed to accept sannyas.
Yes.
That's...
But if they're not, then no.
Why not?
Because they won't be able to maintain the position. Because it's only, you can only have the qualities to actually do it by devotional service. But if you don't have devotional service, you won't actually have the qualities to maintain it properly. So in Kali Yuga, it's just not recommended. But we see Shankara gave it for his people, and then the Vaishnavas. But otherwise, all these other walas that are non-sampradayic, generally it's not that great.
Like those Buddhist monks, you know, they are like sannyasis. You know.
They're like, but they're Buddhists. So they're outside the Vedic system. They can do whatever they like.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, they don't exist anyway. It's all an illusion anyway, so they're not even taking sannyas. So. You can just forget they're there because they're not there. But don't get too close because they think you're not there either. So if you like being around, don't go near them. Okay.
Another question is, can the Kshatriya eat the meat offering to the
deities? Means just specific animals. All the animals that people eat these days are not in the list, means, how you say? are not in the list of what Manu recommends.
Like in ancient China, the kshatriyas, they eat the meat after offer to ancestors.
Yes, no, it'd be the ancestors, but what meat?
Like a horse or like.
They eat on the dragon. Yeah, see, because it's easy, right? What do you call it? What is it? Anything on the land except a car, a rickshaw, anything in the air except a plane, and anything in the water except a boat. So since it's so easy, it's just anything goes, then to actually think of specifics becomes difficult. So there's certain things. So there may be something left from the Vedic times when they had that connection, but the point is it's only in connection with the Shraddha rites, right? With yajna and things like that. It's saying about the Shudras. Then they made goats and other insignificant animals, then offering to the deities, then may eat. But it's only on certain occasions, not just on a regular. So this thing where you have, you know, franchises of, you know, food chains that serve meat, and all of the meat is not recommended. Cows you can't eat, chickens you can't eat, pigs you can't eat, you know. All these kind of things are not to be eaten. Right? So that's not what it's talking about. It means the sacrifice. So what they're talking about here for the Shudras is once in a month they can do that sacrifice. Like that. Does that make sense? And then the Shraddha rites, they have specific times when they're done. So in these 3 months, then there's those 3 months, so only in the dark fortnight. So you'll just be doing the Shraddha rite once. You know, so sometime in there, because you do it once a year, so that means once in a year. You understand? So unless it's something, it's not part of their regular diet. Does that make sense? Yeah, so it's not the, oh, Kshatriyas can eat meat and all this kind of stuff. That's not what we're talking about here. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Marsh, does dark fortnight mean half moon to half moon or from new moon to...
Means from after the full moon to the dark moon.
Okay.
Means the Pratipat after the full moon down to the Amavasya, that's the dark moon. Okay. It's what it ends on, is what we call it. Yeah, okay. When it's waning. Like that. Because that's when the forefathers, that's their daytime. And when it's waxing is their night.
Okay.
So that's why it's done. That, you know, you don't, you know, yeah, so then in the morning, you know, grandfather wakes up and all that. So how do you like the feast and everything? We offered you this huge thing and all that. You know, well, we thought it was fabulous. I hope you liked it. Says, what feast, you know? Yeah, we offered it at 12 o'clock, like that. Says, but I was asleep. You know, so yeah, so that's why you don't do that.
So the full moon's not their noon, the full moon is their night.
Yeah. No, the full moon is the end, is their Brahma Muhurta. Because the waning, that's their day.
Waning's their day.
Yeah. So that means, like on the, you know, the Ostami or something, that's like high noon.
Okay, got it.
So that's why when they come sauntering up to the other guy and tell him, it's Ostami. Yeah, we want you out of town before Ostami, you know, like that. So.
Got it.
Yeah, okay.
Mine?
Yes.
So there are 1 day is equal to over 15 days because the moon is waning.
Their 1 day is our 15. Yeah, and the demigods, our 6 months is their day. So in other words, 1 month, one of our months is 24 hours for the Pitris. And 1 year for us is 24 hours for the demigods. Right? Okay. And then 1,000 yuga cycles, Maha Yugas is Brahma's day and the same time as his night. Okay.
And Pitris, they live? Pitriloka is below Earth?
Pitriloka is where Yamaraj stays, and it's also connected to the moon. So there's a connection between the two. That's why they offer wooden shoes and umbrellas, so that when they're walking to the moon, then there's not a problem.
Pitriloka is somewhere near the hellish planets.
No, it's where Yamaraj stayed.
Yamaraj is having two locations, up and down.
The point is that where Yamaraj is, that's where they are. So it doesn't matter where it's located.
Maybe he has his home and office.
No, but the point is you have all these things. Indra has his place on top of Mount Meru. He also has his place on the Loka mountains.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? So where he is, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then he has, you know, during office hours, then he has, you know, where he meets those who... they're not nice. Because he has different forms also. Right? Like that. So, the Vaitarani River is either this beautiful, wonderful river or this really not so nice river. Depending if you're pious or impious. So for the Vitris, they're pious, therefore they're with Indra. Yamaraj is like a heavenly planet. He's a demigod. It's just situated down there because, you know, the Vedic system is home and office are close together. You know, you live upstairs and the shop's downstairs. Right? Yeah? Yeah. So the same way. As he's there, the hellish planets are next door. So. Okay? Yeah. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued. Vikukshi offered the remnants of the flesh to King Ikshvaku, who gave it to Vashishta for purification. But Vashishta could immediately understand that part of the flesh had already been taken by Vikukshi, and therefore he said that it was unfit to be used in the Shraddha ceremony. Footnote 16. In his purport to verse 8, Srila Prabhupada comments, "That which is meant to be offered in yajna cannot be tasted by anyone before being offered to the deity. In our temples, this regulation is in effect. One cannot eat fruit from the kitchen unless it is offered to the deity. If something is taken before being offered to the deity, the entire preparation is polluted and can no longer be offered. Those engaged in deity worship must know this very well so that they may be saved from committing offenses in deity worship."
I have one question, because in our temple, so many pilgrims come and offer lamps, and sometimes I see they turn on the lamps on those lamps which are already offered. So that must be...
That's not ideal.
Mm.
There should be a lamp at which they light their lamps from.
Yeah. But is that already offered?
It's not offered. That is technically called prashade. It means it's touched something that's prashad. That's why after making an offering you wash your hands before touching the next.
Mm.
So it's not offered. Mm. It's just prashade. It means like prashad touches boga, then the boga becomes prashade. So technically it's not. But there should be a lamp there, that's where you light the lamp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not like considered like seva aparad.
See, in here, you have to take what we're saying and complete the dots. Because all the different offerings means that, but if they're standing on that means now the right side is considered auspicious, so if they light their lamp from the right side of the lamp, is that better than if they let it from the left side? You know, what happens, that, you know, just keep on going. Catch the point. If something's prashad, it touches something that's boga, technically what's boga becomes prashadi, it's not actually proper. Catch that. Don't keep going. But what about? Please don't do that. Okay? You use the thing. We gave the answer. Like that. Okay? Like that. So we're saying there should be a lamp there. So if you're concerned, then put a lamp there. And then tell the people, this is where you light your... They have no problem with that because that's how they do. They don't see anything else. No one's provided. They're just doing it like that. So they're untrained. Like that. But if you're going to start the whole thing, oh no, but it's all that, it's all useless, and all these people, they're all going to hell, and I said, don't do that either. You know, like that. When King Ikshvaku was thus informed by Vashishta, understood what his son Vikukshi had done, he was extremely angry. Thus he ordered Vikukshi to leave the country because Vikukshi had violated the regulative principles. Having been instructed by the great and learned Brahmana Vasishta, who discoursed about the absolute truth, Maharaj Ikshvaku became renounced. By following the principles for a yogi, he certainly achieved the supreme perfection after giving up his material body. After his father's disappearance, Vikukshi returned to the country and thus became the king, ruling the planet Earth and performing various sacrifices to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vikukshi...
Interesting. He couldn't return until Ikshvaku was there. And means Ikshvaku didn't have other sons? Or this one was...
No, it's not necessarily that. It just says he came after.
After what?
Because means that there must have been a certain period of prayaschitya. Yeah, so then whatever that was, he went for that period, but it appears that from this sacrifice, either just in general he heard from Vasishta, or in this sacrifice he heard from Vasishta, and then at some point became like that, so... Because it says after his father's disappearance, it doesn't say when. It may have been 5 years after, it may be the day after, the day after, the day after. You know, those kind of... Vikukshi later became celebrated as Sashada, the eater of a rabbit. Okay. This is not going away easy. Yeah, so it's not just high school, you know. Right? The son of Sashada was Puranjaya, who is also known as Indravaha and sometimes as Kakutsta. Please hear from me how he received different names for different activities. Formerly, there was a devastating war between the demigods and the demons. The demigods, having been defeated, accepted Puranjaya as their assistant and then conquered the demons. Therefore, this hero is known as Puranjaya, he who conquered the residents of the demons. Puranjaya agreed to kill all the demons on the condition that Indra would be his carrier. Because of pride, Indra could not accept this proposal, but later, by the order of the Supreme Lord Vishnu, Indra did accept it and became a great bull carrier for Puranjaya. Yes. Shut up. <right? laughs> Well protected by armor and desiring to fight, Puranjaya took up a transcendental bow and very sharp arrows. And while being highly praised by the demigods, he got up on the back of the bull, Indra, and sat on its hump. Thus, he is known as Kakutsta. Being empowered by Lord Vishnu, who is the Supersoul and the Supreme Person, Puranjaya sat on the great bull and is therefore known as Indravaha. Surrounded by the demigods, he attacked the residents of the demons in the west. There was a fierce battle between the demons and Puranjaya. Indeed, it was so fierce that when one hears about it, one's hairs stand on end. All the demons, bold enough to come before Puranjaya, were immediately sent to the residents of Yamaraj by his arrows. To save themselves from the blazing arrows, Indravaha, which resembled the flames of devastation. At the end of the millennium, the demons who remained when the rest of their army was killed fled very quickly to their respective homes. After conquering the enemy, the saintly king Puranjaya gave everything, including the enemy's riches and wives, to Indra, who carries the thunderbolt. For this, he is celebrated as Puranjaya. Thus, Puranjaya is known by different names of his different activities. The son of Puranjaya was known as Anena. So it's not that he, you know, used Indra as the carrier, and then, you know, in this way, then afterwards, then he was puffed up and everything like that. No, he fought on behalf of the demigods. He gave everything to, because he was fighting for Indra, like that. So I guess he wanted Indra there too long, or Indra would be the best at battle, so he would be the best carrier, or who knows, like that. The son of Puranjaya was known as Anena. Anena's son was Pritu, and Pritu's son was Vishvaganti. Vishvaganti's son was Chandra, and Chandra's son was Yuvanashva. The son of Yuvanashva was Shravasta, who constructed a township known as Shravastipuri. The son of Shravasta was Brihadashva, and his son was Kuvalayashva. In this way, the dynasty increased. To satisfy the sage Utanka, the greatly powerful Kuvalayasva killed a demon named Dundhu. He did this with the assistance of his 21,000 sons. O Maharaj Parikit, for this reason, Kuvalayasva is celebrated as Dundhumara, the killer of Dundhu. All but three of his sons, however, were burnt to ashes by the fire emanating from Dundhu's mouth. The remaining sons were Dridashva, Kapilashva, and Bhadrashva. From Dridashva came a son named Haryashva, whose son was celebrated as Nikumbha. The son of Nikumbha was Bahulashva. The son of Bahulashva was Krishasva. The son of Krishasva was Senajit. And the son of Senajit was Yuvanashva. Yuvanashva had no sons, and thus he retired from family life and went to the forest. Although Yuvanashva went to the forest with his 100 wives, all of them were very morose. The sages in the forest, however, being very kind to the king, began very carefully and attentively performing an Indra Yajna so that the king might have a son. Being thirsty one night, the king entered the arena of sacrifice, and when he saw all the Brahmins lying down, he personally drank the sanctified water meant to be drunk by his wife. When the Brahmins got up from bed and saw the water pot empty, they inquired who had done this work of drinking the water meant for begetting a child. When the Brahmanas came to understand that the king, inspired by the supreme controller, had drunk the water, they all exclaimed, "Alas! The power of providence is real power. No one can counteract the power of the supreme." In this way, they offered their respectful obeisances unto the Lord. Thereafter, in due course of time, a son with all good symptoms of a powerful king came forth from the lower right side of King Yuvanashva's abdomen. The baby cried so much for breast milk that all the Brahmanas were very unhappy. "Who will take care of this baby?" they said. Then Indra, who was worshipped in that yajna, came and solaced the baby. "Do not cry," Indra said. Then Indra put his index finger in the baby's mouth and said, "You may drink me." Because Yuvanashva, the father of the baby, was blessed by the Brahmins, he did not fall a victim to death. After this incident, he performed severe austerities and achieved perfection in that spot. Mandata, the son of Yuvanashva, was the cause of fear for Ravana and other thieves and rogues who caused anxiety. O King Parikit, because they feared him, the son of Yuvanashva was known as Trasadasyu. This name was given by King Indra. By the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the son of Yuvanashva was so powerful, right? Because Mandata was then nursed by Indra, and so then he gave this name. He was so powerful that when he became emperor, he ruled the entire world, consisting of seven islands, without any second ruler. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is not different from the auspicious aspects of great sacrifices, such as the ingredients of the sacrifice, the chanting of the Vedic hymns, and the regulative principles, the performer, the priest, the result of the sacrifice, the arena of sacrifice, and the time of sacrifice. Knowing the principles of self-realization, Mandata worshipped that transcendentally situated supreme soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, who comprises all the demigods. Right? So he is able to see all this, all these aspects of the sacrifice. He saw them all in connection with the Supreme Lord. So because of this, then he's, you know, transcendentally situated. Does that make sense? So that was discussed before, is that with Prithu and Bharat Maharaj, Rishabhdev, then how they performed and how they saw everything connected to the Lord. So then he is on that same platform.
If we don't remember 99% of those names, we just get the benefit by hearing?
Yes. Okay. That's the specialness of Sukadeva Goswami, that he can remember all these. And these are the ones he can speak. He could remember more. Because as you see, he just gives the main ones in the line. In other words, who the line of kings will come down through. Because there's other sons, they also have children. So unless they took up, you know, something more prominent, then they're not even mentioned. Because otherwise you go into thousands of... Yes.
So what's the point of Supreme Goswami? Why is the discussion is going in that direction where he's trying to describe the Supreme Lord? What's the relationship? Why is that important?
You have to wait a few more chapters. Because all these kings will come down to Krishna and Balaram. Then you describe the pastimes. Just like this, you go down kings, you get to Ambarish, then you describe the whole pastime. Right? So then you get down to Krishna and Balaram, then you describe the whole pastime. Right? So that's how Puranas work. You go down through the line of the Prajapatis, and then you describe things as you're going, the Manus, then you describe things you're going, and the kings, and you describe. That's what's discussed in the Purana. Right? Because that's why it's called a history. So, yes.
You mentioned before that this great chapter was riding on bulls.
Right.
We had a discussion in the ministry. If bull riding was an allowed practice in our institution.
Generally, we don't. Out of respect, we don't ride bulls. But I would not, in that frame of mind, then put a ban on Lord Shiva in ISKCON.
That was one of the arguments of that person doing it.
Yeah, means if he's Lord Shiva, he can do all the things that Lord Shiva does, that he's Shiva Tattva, then why not? But since he's Jiva Tattva, then I'm not sure if the argument stands. Because is Shiva the one that we take example from? We take example from be absorbed in meditation, that he doesn't have a house. Does that devotee not have a house? That, you know, he's married with his wife. They just sit under a tree. So why doesn't he take that one? Right? He just wears, you know, hardly anything and that. And he, you know, yeah, like that. You know, wears snakes. You know, so I'm saying if you're going to go for it, you know, how you say, do the full Monty here. Why you're just going to stop at just you like riding bulls? Yeah, so that's the whole point, is that we generally don't ride bulls like that. Brajvasis may do it or not do it, don't worry about that. We are who we are. Well, we always remember that. So, yeah, we generally don't ride cows either. This one. Yeah.
Like that. If there are
horses, camels, they can go for it.
If there are so many dynasties and great kings living in Aryabhata, why we cannot find a much archaeological discovery in this area?
How far down do they dig? Varanasi, is it known as the oldest city on the planet where there's been continuous living? Is it known like that in the archaeological circles or not? You don't know.
Not much.
Okay. No, it's not. How far down do they dig? Right? They just came across Dwarka, like, I don't know, when it was 20, 30 years ago. Are they doing, you know, internationally, are they doing digging there? So you have to understand, as the archaeologists, they'll go dig out in the desert someplace, but they're not going to dig here. Because they don't want to find what's here. What Western scholar wants India to be the center of civilization? Yeah. You understand?
Yes.
No one wants that, so they're not going to dig here.
And also, the Indian government, the protectionists, don't let any other government dig. You know, like they're very, very protective of their archaeology thing because they think, you know, because the British, you know, they find something
and then steal it. Home. Yeah. So they don't dig, so nobody digs.
And then
so.
If you see the budget of the archaeological departments in India, you go, it's ridiculous. See, all they do is put fans and maintain stuff so it doesn't crumble, you know.
I mean, so they have a decent tea budget, but that's about it.
Even that Dwarka expedition, you know, they had this little tail boat. A diving suit that looks from a James Brown movie with Sean Connery from the 60s, you know, diving, and that's the whole Dwarka thing.
Yeah.
This two guy diving.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole point is that it's not, no one pokes their nose over here. You'll see, go back 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, then there was interest. But then as it shows more and more that this may be more of a center, then the interest wanes.
Right? Like in Egypt, there's
Iran. Egypt is cool. You know, they're over that side. In other words, anything non-Vedic can be the source of non-Vedic civilizations. But if everybody, there's the Vedic and everyone's a derivative of that, that won't work out so good for them. Why is it that all those people who came into Europe, because Europe is just there, came from, they just say they came somewhere from the, what do you call it? The north, the southeast. Everybody who came into Greece, they came from the southeast. They don't know where. Who came into Italy, from the southeast. I mean, there is a southeast. It's called Central Asia.
Like Alexandra Magna.
Sorry?
Alexandra Magna.
Maybe. It's just the point is that nobody wants to get into that much. But if you go into Central Asia, they have things that are going back and all that, and it's understood the sages used to hang out there. Caspian Sea is that Kasyapa's ashram was over there. You know what I'm saying? But no one wants to get into that because it only should go back, you know, a certain amount of time, right? Everyone's supposed to be, you know, Neanderthal, go back, what, 40,000 years or something. You know? So when you have it that, no, there was a brilliant civilization of you know, how you say, modern man in India doing quite well, and the rest of the world was sitting in a cave and it's time for his son's marriage, so they pick up the club, you know, and you know, so like that. It doesn't look very good. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So the point is history is written by the who wins. Right?
Ramitas Swami's book is going to searching for India, debunks this whole stuff.
Yeah, no, it's there. It means others have done, they have researches there, but the point is that that's not going to be mainstream, because mainstream, it has to show that Europe is the center of the universe. And that's all. Western Europe, of course.
But if we have like strong archaeological proof, you know, then
but will they accept it as proof? There is strong archaeological proof, as in what was it called, forbidden archaeology. There is stuff. They're digging and they find, you know, something that matches their theory, and then something that doesn't. They'll just say, oh, polluted the site. There was a fissure in the earth and this skull fell inside here, but otherwise it should have been 10 feet higher up. They just do like that. They're materialists. That's why we say speculation. It's just speculation. Because that's how they want it to go. Right? You find one cheekbone and they construct a whole body from it. You know? One bone, you have this whole dinosaur. Have you ever seen an elephant a skeleton? Would you ever know that it has a trunk? No, they have a very different, means ours has a front, theirs doesn't. So how would you even know what's on the front of that? So when they make things up, God only knows what they are. You know what I'm saying? You have an animal that catches other animals and eats them in his cave, and then it dies in the cave, so all those bones are mixed, and now you put that all together, and then you have your dinosaur. You know? You know what I'm saying? You say scientific, but scientific is just going out in the... Yeah, I can't remember who did it. Maybe it was Monty Python. They went out to the local tip, you know, the garbage dump. And they went there, and they're archaeologists, and they're doing a whole thing there and that. And I think they find an old phone or something, and then they're going on about how this goes here and this is there. And then they're constructing this whole lifestyle and everything from that, until somebody pointed out, hey, that's an old, you know, what are you doing with the phone? And, oh, okay. And then they go dig somewhere up right now. It's they themselves speculate, and then they work out a agreed upon method of their speculation, and then they pat each other on the back that they're the authorities, and then they block that anybody else can be the authority. How is this knowledge? So we say scientific proof. What science? Does that make sense? That's the whole point. Ayurveda, there's something. You have a herb, you don't know what it is. There's 20 different tests you can do on it to figure out what it does so that you can include it in your repertoire. But in the modern, you go through tens of thousands of ways of using. So they don't know. It's by accident. Penicillin was by accident. The guy's a slob. You know, most people get rid of their bread earlier. He left it around. He's a slob. Right? So, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. It means the sooner we have faith in God's laws and not in those who observe, just look at the laws. In other words, God's laws and those who follow those laws, as opposed to those who just on the outside observe them but don't actually care about them and claim that they're their own. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, so. We're good?
Okay.
He also gave immense charity to the Brahmanas, and thus he performed yajna to worship the Lord. All places from where the sun rises on the horizon, shining brilliantly to where the sun sets, are known as the possession of the celebrated Mandata, the son of Yuvanashva. Mandata begot three sons. In other words, you know, if the sun never sets, means the whole thing's his. Like that. Mandata begot three sons in the womb of Bindumati, the daughter of Shashabindu. These sons were Purukutsa, Ambarisha, and Muchukunda, a great mystic yogi. These three brothers had 50 sisters, who all accepted the great sage Saubhari as their husband. Okay, so end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi ki.